Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe.
Sponsored by Wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.
Hi, everyone. I'm Larry Port. Welcome to another episode of the Dream Job Cafe. With me today is my old friend, Victor Medina. Victor is an awesome guy, and he does a whole bunch of stuff with estate planning and retirement planning and financial management. So, Victor, welcome.
Hey, thanks. Well, great to be here, Larry.
Victor, do you have a title, or is it CEO now, or what is it?
Yeah, I get one of those like cute ones where I'm the chief excitement officer for my companies. Founder is probably the best title for what I do because I have three or four different companies. And so within them, they're all under one umbrella. I'm just kind of the guy that, I don't know, you either have to answer to, run away from, or otherwise, you know, just answer to, I guess, maybe.
That's great. All right. So tell me, like, what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so we're got these sister companies that help people lead great lives in retirement. And the way that we do that is by helping them plan for their financial, legal, tax lives so that what they can do is kind of be free to go be more interested in the things that aren't worrying about what the bank account is and whether or not they'll have enough to survive. That's the day-to-day, meeting with clients to do that, coaching my team to step in. We kind of work as a team that has one client base. Rather than having individual advisors that have their own clients, we have specialists that all focus on different areas of what a retirement life might be like. And so my job is kind of to make sure that that engine is running, continue to feed into it, whether it's through marketing and rainmaking, whether it's sales and meeting with people, whether it's problem solving at higher levels, because I just learned, Larry, that I am the oldest person in my firm.
And oh, no.
That's kind of, it's weighing in on me. They come to me like I'm wise and I'm the old guy that comes in, but I'm playing the part because I've got reading glasses in every room that I might walk into just so I have them when I need them. But that's really what I'm doing, is trying to mentor these other folks in there so that they can go exercise judgment at a higher and higher level and, you know, have be less reliant on me, really.
That's awesome. By the way, I mean, you know, at some point you embrace it. I'll send you a vest for Christmas, you know? Okay. So, you know, I think it's a really interesting thing what you do. First of all, you're in this field where, you know, there are so many people getting older, going into retirement. I mean, demographically, it's huge. But I love the fact that it's like, it gets, you know, you started here with, when I met you, you were trust and estate planning attorney, and it's grown into this thing. Right.
That really was the journey. I've been an attorney for 23 years. And when I started my practice, it didn't start doing estate planning attorney. That came kind of a year or two into it. Then we stayed with that for about 10 years until we started adding financial services, largely in response to what clients were saying they needed and what I observed out in the marketplace as being kind of done not well with an opportunity to do better. And so for the last 11 years from that, we've had both of the things together, but it kind of grew organically, whereas, you know, starting to focus in estate planning, focus on the older portion of that, helping people protect assets if they go into a nursing home, then adding the financial services component that was related to the legal, then getting more full spectrum of all the financial services, where now the lead relationship is on the financial side, and the law firm is mostly a service arm, kind of a department to those clients that work on the financial side, as opposed to the other way around, where it kind of led with legal for many, many years.
Wow. So, and when you were thinking of entering the profession of law, like, when did that start? Was that like something that you were thinking about in high school or college? Like, how did this play out?
I have to give credit to my wife. So my wife, when we met, I had just graduated from college. She was I can say this here because it's true and I've already paid the penalty for it, but she was a little older than I was. So we were about 3 years difference. At that time, she was she was a mature, accomplished 25-year-old meeting a baby 22-year-old, okay? So we won't do the math for where she is right now. But as we were going through dating, she said to me in these words, "Look, you're reasonably intelligent, but if you don't get another degree, people are going to think that you're full of crap for the rest of your life. So I don't care what you do, but if you want to stay with me, you got to go back to medical school, business school, law school."
Really?
One of these. And I thought, okay, sounds good. I want to stay with you. Let me go look at that. I really didn't like business school. That wasn't going to be for me. medical school, I didn't do any of the pre-work for that, so kind of left me with an option. And as I took the test and applied, I got a full scholarship to go to law school. And so I said, hey, let's go ahead and do that. And then we got engaged 2 months after I started, married somewhere in the middle of it, and haven't looked back. So I can give her all of the credit.
That's a similar story to me, except for my case, I had to cut my hair. So, all right. So you go to law school, and then did you think, was she like, listen, you need to get a big job in a big firm, or was she not?
No,
like that?
She was never a driver. No, Larry, she was never a driver about that. It wasn't about accomplishment or achievement. For her, it was really legitimizing the presence that I brought about having ideas on things and wanting to take lead and solve problems. And so it was really a function of, I just want you to stand in a room and have people listen to you for those reasons. As I went through, I did the accomplishment achievement thing. I got the best of what the grades were. I got a federal clerkship, which in the legal field is like a badge of honor that there's a federal judge that wants to hire you for a year. I worked at the large law firm. I got that by summering in a big city where they go in and it's like a big recruitment thing, kind of like it is with investment banking. So I did all of those steps. And when I started that job at that high, big law firm, high salary place, I was doing all the work that you would expect for that. Long hours there to 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, had our first child and spent 9 hours trying to get home for Thanksgiving one day and going, nah, I'm good with this. Went from the large city to a smaller city, kind of still doing that work. And at that point in time, I kind of recognized I was not in a position where I was going to have the relationships necessary to become an equity partner. I didn't know anybody at a big company. I had no friends and connections. Nobody went off to a business school that were working in that level that could throw me that work. And they had this phrase that called a service partner, which is if you worked long enough, you could kind of be connected with the person that really pulled the strings. That never sat with me well. Mm-hmm. And so pregnant with our second child, my wife was, when I decided I'm just going to leave and start my own thing, which was insane.
Yeah, it's nuts. Time.
Completely nuts. And at that time, there was a Mac user group that existed, and it was a technology group. It wasn't a job bank, but I got introduced to somebody who posted a job just randomly looking for an associate attorney in my area, in Princeton, New Jersey. And so I answered and I said, I'm not into a job any longer, but if you got per diem, if you got some cash flow for me, I'm here and I need it. And he said, actually, I've been trying to get a partnership-based exit from my law firm. And so why don't we talk about you buying me out and inheriting this law firm? And he was a guy that practiced in school law, something I had never done anything with. But he trained me for a year and a half, trained me to be an outstanding school law attorney. That's not on me. It's just really on his training. And after that, as we started to kind of go from one government contract to the next government contract, and there was a lot of swing and volatility, big six-figure contracts, I was like, this makes me a little seasick. We started adding estate planning because at that time I was doing a lot of labor negotiations with teachers, which meant I started at 3 p.m. and didn't end till like midnight. And the last thing I wanted to do was go into court the next day. So at least with estate planning, either you're dead already or you're planning for a time that you might be dead, but it's not tomorrow.
Right.
So I could put my calendar pretty well set up where I could start later in the day and kind of take that work in stride. And that's really where the focus began in estate planning.
Wow. That's such an interesting story. I also have to say though, that like, I feel like there's never a good time to start a business or have a baby or buy a car or buy a house. Like, so you might as well just do it. Somebody told me that. And I think within 3 months or so, I started my own company. But kudos to you. And man, what a wild journey. I also want to point out is that I've interviewed a bunch of people now. And these journeys are like this. Like, you have people who are hungry and they're smart and these opportunities arise and they seize them. And the career is never what you imagine it would be like when you're in high school, but it kind of just zigzag up like that.
There would be no point in time in any of my formative years, whether you want to start that like a freshman in high school, or you want to look at it when I was in college and kind of studying, I had a psychology degree, even when I was in kind of professional training school, even as I was going to law school, where you could have predicted, or I would have agreed with the prediction, said, you're going to come and do this. It's going to be out in the future a few years, but you're going to be there. I would have thought you were nuts. It did nothing jived about that whole sequence of things. Even the period of time where I was a school law attorney, which I was for a long period. So as I was building the estate planning attorney, I still held on to a number of school districts because there was a specific expertise that I had that they needed, whether it was helping them build buildings, or in one case, we had a district that had a lot of military students that were on there. And so that was a kind of a unique knowledge base in there, held on to that for a long time. I would never have predicted that I could be that person standing in that room, giving that kind of value to somebody else. Back if you'd asked me at any of the first 8, 12, 13 years of kind of figuring out where I was going to go.
Yeah, it's amazing. One thing you also mentioned, you kind of said that you were in this Mac user group. The way that I met you is because you were a Mac using attorney back when people weren't using Macs commonly. Right. In fact, one thing I want our viewers and listeners to understand is that Victor is so kind of far out on the bleeding edge of technology usage and its applications that he was, I think, the second or third attorney that ever saw my product when I built it back in 2006 or 2007. So with that, like, you know, this is a rare opportunity to like really ask somebody in the know, as best as anybody has a crystal ball, you have it. Yeah. How do you see everything playing out in legal? And then we could even talk about, you know, financial planning or retirement planning. Like, how is this stuff going to be affected by AI? And is it going to affect the opportunities that young people will have, like getting careers in this field?
Yeah, both of those industries share similarities around A, their professional services with typically high touch, very deep relationships with individuals. And so there is any subset of, you know, people that says, I'm just going to get a will online, or I'm just going to do my financial planning, you know, kind of using a robo-advisor. But for the people that were going to pay for those services, one of the reasons why they decide to pay for those services and hire somebody is based on a personal connection. And because of that, the industry has largely, both of them, been insulated from technological advances. They go like donkeys being dragged along forever and ever. Attorneys never thought about using any form of a system to help them with that.
Right.
That's why your product was so successful, because it was the first time it was like, oh, this might be helpful and it's easy to use. And so you experienced it. I've seen it from my vantage point. One of my side hustles is coaching other attorneys to have better practices. And so I've been able to observe watching them go slowly through technology. The problem is that the technology right now is screaming past them, just in its capacity. And I've never been a person that has said that the technology itself would eliminate any part of what the practice is. But I have been a firm believer that those practitioners that use the technology well will be able to kind of outperform, outlast the people that don't. We saw it very, very specific. Like it was tangible at COVID, where the people that knew how to host Zoom meetings, the lawyers and financial advisors who were kind of just eschewed technology, could conduct business online, quickly capitalized on the people that were still trying to figure out, do I have enough of a connection to talk to somebody? It's going to be the same way for AI. And so we've seen that. And my biggest obstacle is trying to get my team to use the tools and leverage, because I was an early adopter and I saw it. But what I want is I want my team of 10 to be able to do what a team of 100 can do, and getting them comfortable with the idea that that technology, the skill set, is their job security rather than a threat to their future job. That's really the art to trying to adopt it. And so I do think it's going to massively have value as long as we embrace it and we use it for what it's really good for, as opposed to seeing it as a luxury kind of stock replacement for the services itself. We have to figure out how to deliver higher and higher value, get very narrow on the things that we do. I'll give you a practical thing, because that was really kind of
sure
woo-woo scenario.
Okay.
The legal field often spends hours and translates those dollars to dollars. They'll bill by the hour. They'll bill by the difficulty of time spent. AI is going to eliminate that. One of the areas that I think is really going to get upended in the personal side of it is matrimonial work. Those firms make their money by individuals spending hours on cases and really racking the billable hours is one of the last to switch to value-based billing or flat billing. They go kicking and screaming in that area. The ability to do more work faster, and you're seeing this in some of the professional ethics opinions, is going to require you to actually do the work faster and only bill for the work that you're currently doing. So you're massively going to put pressure on your marketing to get the volume of work up, because you're going to need volume since you're not going to make your money based on your ability to spend time in an area. It's those types of things. The same thing with doing investment trading. There's nobody that should be picking any investments any longer or pushing any more buttons. There's no art to that. But the art that comes with judgment that says, hey, this is what income looks like in the future. Or if you want a better outcome, a more enjoyable outcome, switch to something that comes in every month so you have to spend it, that behavioral finance component of it. That's really where we have to spend more time, because the other stuff is going to quickly get cannibalized by what technology can do.
Okay, so like a couple things to tease out of that. Number one is that the Wall Street Journal, of all places, covered the billable hour recently and how AI would affect it. I was like astounded to see that, like, all this stuff that we've been talking about for so long was there. The second thing is that, like, correct me if I'm wrong, it does sound like you're in a fundamentally human business, and you may be more in the, there seems to be two camps with this AI stuff. There seems to be the augmentation camp versus the replacement camp, and it sounds like you're more in the augmentation camp.
First of all, I think I have to be. You know, if I'm disclosing bias, I'm not trying to get rid of the value that I think I can bring by saying I can and will be replaced by technology. I want to push against that and say, well, I think that technology is going to have a really great role, AI specifically, but just the ability to kind of leverage what it is that we're capable of doing. Yeah, I want to embrace that, because I would prefer to focus on the things that only the human elements of it can continue to bring. Will that get shrunk? Sure. The things that we didn't think were possible for AI to do, with kind of natural language responses and its ability to not be constrained by certain biases, yeah, I think that there's going to be something in that world. But first, it's going to take a while to get there. Second, if we start to, as you say, kind of use it as an augmentation for what we have, we can navigate through how do we define what better value is and how do we stay relevant going forward. If we put our heads in the sand, there's no way we're going to be where it is at the time that we need to be there.
So this is all very interesting. Now, let's say that there is somebody that wants to get involved with this field. Do you think this is a promising field? Instinctively, I would think that given the aging population, that estate planning would be a great field of law for people to go into, retirement planning too. I'm curious to hear what you think. You have kids in school. Thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, I do. A few things, and they're more human than they are about the industry, and we'll kind of get to the industry. The human elements of it is there is a lot of emotion wrapped up in the security that finances bring to a picture, right? Nothing threatens your sense of calm more than not having cash or having any kind of money insecurity. So being able to translate or get people from being fearful about where they are and what the future holds to being confident, I think is always going to be valuable. And so that's going to span different things. You may focus the industry. Let's focus on the financial services side. The industry first focused on that by deciding which investments to buy. And very quickly, and those were kind of stockbrokers that would come and sell and movies made about it. But very quickly realized there's not a lot of value in that, not any longer. So then it started to switch over into product selection. Amongst the different investments realm that you can be in, how do we learn how to distribute to this? That also got solved, and it's not particularly difficult to go figure that out. Then we got to the area of taxes, and now tax planning is an extremely valuable additional service to bring. So it's always been progressive to the point of saying there are other areas you can pay attention to. I don't think we've found the end of them. And so if we're going to figure out, is this industry good for people to get into? It's good for two reasons. One, the need will always be there to help people navigate through something that's really complex. The second is that it's incredibly rewarding. And so when you go through that and you make something possible for someone that they didn't think was possible, there is a reward beyond the dollars that you're making that is worth it. And so when we think about the true outcome of our work, It's not that we've put together a great retirement plan. The true outcome of our work is that we help people lead great lives. That the when they look backwards, it's that the 10, 20, or 30 years that we work together, they look back and say, those were the best years of my life. If that's how we can translate the relationship, then that's really, really valuable. And for other people are like, what am I going to get out of this besides just a paycheck? Like, you're going to get that. You're going to help make people's dreams come true. You're going to help facilitate things they never thought were possible. And that is rewarding in and of itself. And it's nice that it pays some cash too.
I can testify firsthand the value of this work because we have a financial advisor. And yeah, they'll go over like where things are invested. But we also like, to me, the favorite page is, okay, like when you're 60, you're going to be worth this. When you're 70, you're going to be worth this with this level of probability. And then like, oh, you're thinking about like doing that addition to the house. Well, you can do it. And you're thinking about doing that. Well, yeah, you can do it up to this certain point. So like, it really helps us like live our lives with confidence without even thinking about things. So
yeah. And the way that I think about it too, Larry, is it is the a method for creating and imparting wisdom. And by wisdom, what I mean is understanding how your short-term actions have a long-term impact. Because you know you have a choice to put the addition on or don't. What you don't know is, if I do this, will I still be okay? And so getting to borrow wisdom and go, here's a way that we can help answer that question. It may not always be that you can put the addition on, but at least the wisdom came in and said, that might be a mistake, or you'll have to trade this if for that. That's where that kind of value comes over. Is like, I can help you see multiple turns ahead so you don't go careening off the mountain and you can stay on and do what you want.
So who should go into this field, do you think, and who absolutely should not?
You know, this field is rife with a spectrum of individuals that all are successful. And I think all of them have a place, but kind of let me put them into categories. There are people that absolutely geek out at the numbers aspect of it. What they really like is the part of the industry that is concrete, that helps them do math, that helps them, that has a kind of a predictable result. The thing foots at the end, there's a lot of spreadsheets, they like them. There is a place for all those people. In fact, I hire some of them because it's not a thing that I do naturally well, is to get spreadsheets working, pivot tables. Please don't. And so there are people that will bring value because they can help those numbers mean something. Then there's another pair of people. There's another part of the industry, people that will come in that have got great human skills, that understand what human problems look like and how to help solve them. And so I'll give you an example. I focus on retirement planning. And one of the most important skills that we can bring to a discussion, kind of just helping people think through, is how are they going to redefine their identity when their identity is no longer defined by getting up at 8:30 in the morning, working till 5:30, 5 days a week with 3 weeks off? That's not because the job was the only thing. It was like, even when they came home, their identity was partially that. That's going to disappear. And so if you want to think about having a successful retirement, one of the things you have to do is figure out a new purpose for what your time is spent, because you're going to get that identity ripped away from you. If that's a skill set that you have, and that's an area that you enjoy, you can go into this field as well, because you help people see something that's possible just on the other side of a door that they can't see walking through beforehand. Both of those people have got a place, I think.
Gotcha. Who should not join this profession?
I hate the people in this profession that are in it just for the money. And by this profession, I mean both legal and financial. There is an incredible amount of money to be made, for sure. I live in the greater Philadelphia area, and it was until recent that all three major sports arenas were sponsored by financial institutions. It was like the Wells Fargo Arena, the Lincoln Financial Field, the Citizens Bank Park, and you would drive by all of them, this one little stretch in 95, and you go, well, I guess that's where my money's going. There's a lot of money that's to be made. If you focus solely on the money to be made because it's an industry that you're greedy about that, first of all, it's a disservice to the industry. But second, you won't be rewarded from that beyond the dollars, which is going to be a very, very short plank for you to walk off. Once you've got them, you don't know what to do. The other thing I think is there are people that can't, this is not an industry that is about being out in the field very much. Like one of my sons, I've got three. One of my sons is a photographer, loves photography. If you ask him to sit at a desk, this is not going to be a great match for him.
No way, right?
Doesn't even think, like, not don't want any part of that. Needs to be out in the world. Well, we don't go out and see the world very much. You know, a lot of this work is, I've got two screens. not just one. You know, I sit in a chair, I've got a keyboard, the keyboard has got a number pad. Those are the kinds of environments where we thrive, and I get to have conversations with people. There's human elements of it. I sit at a table and a desk or do a Zoom or something like that. So I have human interaction, but I'm mostly in this space to do something. It's a black box of stuff that comes in and out. And I think those people that can't work well in the black box, probably not a great match.
Oh, that's great advice. That's great advice. Now, you're hiring a lot of young people, so, and you have your own kids that are entering the workforce soon. So I guess, like, what do you look for? How do you think about, like, youth entering your business and their career trajectories? I don't know if that's something you give a lot of thought to, a little bit of thought to.
It's something I give a fair amount of thought to, one, because I am very vested in my oldest son about to graduate, being successful in his launch. He's always welcome home, but I would like him to have a good launch, to kind of think through that. And then obviously we've had been in a position where we've hired a lot of people, and more recently, a ton of young people. There's more people under the age of 30 working with me now than there ever has been, or more than there are over 30. So that's kind of the break point off of it. And it's an interesting phenomenon to walk through, because I'm not one of these people who's like, oh, that generation all thinks this or the other. It's not been my experience. Yeah. I don't think that millennials go into a category. I don't think the generation Y or whatever else goes into a category that you can predict. People aren't like that. But what I have experienced is that there is a divide between people having a sense of, I don't know if it's entitlement, but feeling like the road from where they begin to where they get to their highest competency is short rather than long, is easy rather than difficult. And when I, having lived through it, and I think in teaching my children about it, I said, your willingness to sit through a storm is the thing that makes you valuable. I don't know any shortcuts. I don't know people that have been successful with great balances where it became easy for them. And so understanding that the road is difficult and that the difficulty defines your value going forward, your willingness to roll your sleeves up, understanding, especially in this, look, there's two paths to go through. You can go through a path where you work with a larger employer where things are very well established and the path upwards is very well defined. That has its limitations. I don't hire people that are interested in that. And those people are not very successful working with me. And then you work places that are more like where we work, smaller companies, where the path is less defined. The responsibilities are broader, right? So it's not as narrow. It's like, I got hired to do this. Yeah, but today the garbage needs to be taken out. So Right. Everyone's got to figure out how to
more
do that.
More hats.
Yeah, more hats. And that for me is more exciting. And I want my children to be involved in that to the extent that they have the opportunity, because you get a broader experience to see what you actually like and are good at. If you get hired into a very narrow role, you are a senior technician level 2, and in 2 years you can become level 1 if your reports work out just the right way, all of your performance reviews. That path is very long. It's very well defined, which means that, like, if you don't like where it's on there, you have to start over in a very different place and kind of just, you just threw out whatever the experience is. And it's so when I look, sorry, I didn't answer your question. When I look to hire, what I'm really looking for is, first of all, what level of grit and flexibility do they possess? Because for me to remain relevant in the industry to become successful, I've got to be nimble. I can't be rigid or I will break when the things are pressured. And so I need people that are willing to be flexible with me. Or else, don't get me wrong, I'll be flexible. They just won't be here. And so I'm trying to find people that I don't have to let excuse or replant someplace else because they lack that flexibility. And I know that's not really a concrete skill in the sense of, like, you go in and be like, did you take these classes? Do you have this degree? Do you have this experience? But I come at it a little bit differently, Larry, which is that of the three C's in hiring, character, culture, and competence, the one I care least amount is competence. I care least about competence. I can train competence. I think that the really great workers can become competent. I call them team members. But the point is, if you have the gray matter and you have the ganas and desire, you can be competent because it's not difficult to train you to do something. But what I can't do is change who your mama made you. So your character is what it is. I hire for character. And when you show up here, you are the culture. I'm fond of saying you don't get the culture as a business owner that you want. you get the culture that you are, which is made up of the individuals. So I'm hiring for those intangibles because we're going to be asked to do lots of different things. Yes, there's a defined thing that we're being asked to do, but more and more, it's going to change. And so what I want is really great character people invested in our culture, because what they're going to do is going to change over time. But if they start out with those things, those are going to be really great winning qualities.
Wow. And like for kids going into this kind of a profession, is it, how do they think about the actual work? This is more of a less lofty question, but more of a nuts and bolts question. Are they, is it a 40 hour a week type of job? Is it weekends? Is it?
Yeah, it is. It is in most professional services, at least the people that are doing it well, it is that the client's needs supersede your own as the professional. That's what a fiduciary relationship is all about, that their interests are higher than yours. And we deal with things that have got real consequences if they're not done or if they're done incorrectly. And so our standards are high. That standard is for participation as well, although I really don't like to ask people to work outside of normal hours. We try to design something. But I'll give you a very concrete example. We are recording this towards the end of the calendar year. The end of the calendar year is a big tax planning time.
I'm sorry.
And a big time for it is a big time for what they call RMDs, or distributions out of retirement accounts.
Right.
It doesn't really matter what it is, but the point is that it's the season for it.
A lot of work.
And that means in this season, it's whatever it takes to get it done. And if that means that we're staying longer, if it means that that's just what it is, because you got into something that was a helping profession, helping people, and you've got an obligation to deliver on their kind of the expectations that you will be there for them. But that is seasonal at best. And I think that the day-to-day work of being able to open up a statement, digest it, look at a report, understand what needs to happen next, have a conversation and act diligently on it. So somebody comes in with a client, says, I need money from this, or this is what I'm thinking about doing, being able to see something through to the end. That's really the day-to-day stuff, is kind of getting inputs or things that need to get done and getting the outputs done correctly and on time. And so from that perspective, the day-to-day has got a lot of, I don't know if this is really a term, but multimodal, long task lists of things that are going in there. You're never going to do the same thing all the time. People aren't done that way, or we don't practice it that way. And you're not going to be slow with nothing to do. There's always something that needs to get done. And so I think kind of understanding that every day is going to be different, and there's going to be some concrete things that you got to get done, some math that has to be right, some buttons have to be pressed correctly, some outcomes that have to be delivered on time. That will be more of what the day-to-day looks like for anybody getting into this, whether in the marketing side of professional services or if they're in the implementation side of actually being an advisor or a paraplanner, kind of coming in at a ground level.
Well, Victor, this was such an awesome interview because I think we got to take a look at estate planning. We got to think a little bit about financial planning, retirement planning, all these kind of things all wrapped up into one. So I just want to thank you so much for helping me out with this. So thank you, Victor.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, listen, I have a vested interest because I recommended this podcast to my kid. I said, you got to go listen to this guy. He's really, really smart. He's talking about a lot of things that might be interesting to you. I'm going to maybe appear on there, but you can skip my episode and go to the other people instead. So anything I can do to help support you spreading this out, especially to a generation that needs to hear this, I think are facing a lot of challenges, you know, I'm happy to participate and do what I can to help anybody that's listening.
Oh, thank you. And amen. So if you like this episode, like it, share it with your friends, and if you can today, please be grateful for something.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Dream Job Cafe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to check out wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.